I'm Nish Weiseth.
I'm Amy Sullivan, and this is Impolite Company, a show where we talk about the tricky subjects polite people are supposed to avoid, especially religion and politics.
This week, evangelicals are back in rotation with four, count them, four major pieces hitting publications about the role and status of evangelicals in the current political moment. We'll take a look at one of them, Michael Gerson's cover story for The Atlantic, and give you our inside take on what's really happening in the world of evangelicalism.
This week also marks the fifth anniversary of Pope Francis's election to the papacy. I talked to Anthea Butler, professor of religious studies at the University of Pennsylvania, who you can also hear for the next 5 weeks on CNN's docuseries, Pope, the Most Powerful Man in History. We discussed his legacy so far, as well as what we might be able to expect from him going forward. After the interview, Nish and I will break down our own reflections and observations.
But first, a bit of housekeeping. Don't forget that you now have the opportunity to support Impolite Company by becoming a monthly patron of the show. You can click the link in your player's episode description, or you can visit us, our page, at patreon.com/impolitecompanypodcast to sign up. It's really easy, and you can invest in the future of this great show for as little as $1 a month. We've got some fun incentives for you to enjoy after signing up, too. So we try to make it worth your while here at Impolite Company.
It's the support of our listeners that helps us create interesting episodes that include interviews with brilliant people. Which brings us to a second thing we wanted to chat about here at the top. Last week, we explored the controversial practice of Christians holding seders at Passover and parties to celebrate the Jewish holiday of Purim. We interviewed Mark Oppenheimer, who provided exceptional insight, both as a religious scholar and as a practicing Jew himself. The point we made in the episode, and that Nish and I made bluntly and Mark made a little bit more diplomatically, is that it's not okay to Christianize Jewish holidays.
And we've gotten some pushback about the episode on social media, with a number of Christians raising their hands and saying things like, "But our celebrations are culturally sensitive." Listen, if you're celebrating Jewish holidays and practicing Jewish traditions and you don't have Jewish folks present at the least or leading the practice at best, then it's not culturally sensitive. No matter how good your intentions may be, it's just not. But we've also received a lot of feedback from our Jewish listeners thanking us for making the points we did. And they were relieved to hear us make the argument against this specific model of appropriation. So our note is, fellow Christians, maybe their response should tell you something.
It's been almost 2 months since Nish got rid of her Twitter account. Because of her exodus, we now kick off our show every week with 3 minutes of Nish, wherein she gets to rage about whatever it is she would have gotten out of her system if she was still unloading her thoughts 280 characters at a time. Nish, take it away.
Oh boy. Okay. On Tuesday, March 12th, the president of the Family Research Council and arch nemesis of the pod, Tony Perkins, had some things to say about those of us who have criticized the religious right over their completely unsurprising silence over the Stormy Daniels scandal. Perkins, on his radio show, said that this criticism was happening for the sole purpose of, quote, shaming evangelicals for their political participation, unquote. And he actually went on to say, quote, folks, you have no reason to be ashamed of supporting this president. He has kept his promises. And as long as he continues to keep those promises and he continues to conduct himself in a way that is in keeping with the office, I'm sorry, I can't say it without laughing. You know, if he were to engage in behavior like Bill Clinton, we're out of here. That support would evaporate quickly, unquote. Okay, asshole. Point number one, what in the actual hell? Point number two, pop quiz, Tony Perkins. You say that Donald Trump and Bill Clinton's actions are different. Is that A, convenient forgetfulness of history? B, a moralistic sellout because Donald Trump happens to share your political party affiliation? Or C, total bullshit? Or D, all of the above? Point number three, Donald Trump keeps his promises? Which promise was that? The promise to give you a Supreme Court justice, or the promise of fidelity that he made to his wife when he got married? Or actually, you know what? Here's a better question. Which promise is more important to you, Tony Perkins? Because if I recall, the latter was a deal breaker with Bill Clinton. Point number four, he continues to conduct himself in a way that is in keeping with the office. Okay, which conduct exactly are you referring to, Tony? Would that be calling countries in Africa and Haiti shithole countries? Would that be his bragging about sexually assaulting women? Would that be his mocking a disabled reporter? Or would that be calling immigrants rapists and murderers? Or would that be siding with neo-Nazis in Charlottesville? Which one of those fantastic examples of his exceptional conduct is most befitting of the office, Tony? Pray tell. Point number five. You are a morally bankrupt pawn, and you have no business speaking for people who claim to follow Jesus after selling out the soul of the Christian faith for the equivalent of three pieces of silver. So go crawl back into the bigoted hole from whence you came. That's what I have to say.
But how do you really feel about Tony Perkins?
Sorry, he really got me this week. Oh, God, that felt good. I needed to get that out of my system. Okay. I feel so much better. Thank you for that free therapy here this afternoon. I appreciate it.
Impolite Company delivers results.
So, you know, we're here for you, listeners. You're welcome.
So this actually provides a pretty good transition to our first topic of the day, which is Michael Gerson's cover story for The Atlantic, which is titled The Last Temptation. In the piece, Gerson dissects the history of evangelicalism, particularly its marriage to politics, and most currently its overwhelming embrace of Donald Trump. Let's not forget that 81% of white evangelicals in 2016 voted for Donald Trump. Before we talk about the essay itself, I wanted to provide a little context for it, and I'll be honest. I have been mad about this piece since I first learned about it a month or so ago. Gerson was George W. Bush's main speechwriter during his first term in the White House, and since leaving that post, Gerson has basically filled the role of thoughtful conservative who is mostly reasonable. He's essentially the David Brooks of the Washington Post. And there is a value to having somebody in that position and on the right who can critique the religious right and to whom other people can point and say, well, even Michael Gerson is saying this about them. But like another New York Times columnist, Ross Douthat, Gerson has also devoted a lot of his writing to blaming cultural decline on progressive Christians. He has accused us of being moral relativists who have no fixed beliefs and of stripping the religious tenets of Christianity and replacing them with politics. And whenever we criticize the religious right, that is, whenever we tried to bring his attention to precisely the things he's now bemoaning about contemporary evangelicalism, he complained that we were elitist who didn't understand the hearts of true Christians. So, yeah. While it's clear that Gerson, who grew up in a conservative evangelical home and graduated from Wheaton College, is truly grieving what has happened to his tradition, he is part of the problem himself. And not only does he not recognize that, but he continues to be part of the problem, including in this essay. It's fear-mongering about progressive Christians as no good, social gospel loving, but otherwise non-believing secularists that has kept evangelicals from dealing with their own problems for lo these many decades. Gerson does provide quite a history of American evangelicalism in this piece, but it's what he doesn't include that is most fascinating. We will get to more of that, including his really blinkered treatment of racism, but I just want to throw out one example here at the top. Gerson says almost nothing about evangelicalism during George W. Bush's presidency. And what makes that so notable is that by now, many social scientists are now pinpointing that era as when the rise of the religious nuns began, when Americans were so turned off by a kind of religion that served partisan goals that they started to prefer affiliating with no religion at all. So the downturn that he really spends a lot of his writing decrying and laying at the feet of liberal Christianity, which he would say is so uninspiring that people are leaving liberal churches in droves, he is really completely unable to see the roots of that in the bad reputation that evangelicalism got and the bad reputation that religion in general got during his time in the White House.
Yeah. He did make a couple of good points. And I do want to not throw the whole article out. I mean, it's full for one. Gosh, I don't know about you, but man, my newsfeed is filled with it. People are sharing it left and right. And which again, is good. I'm glad that someone like Michael Gerson, we can look to and say okay, look, even this guy is saying something is bad. Again, I mean, how much power that's going to have out of a publication like The Atlantic, we'll see. But I don't necessarily think that a bunch of super right wing Fox News listening people are going to go click on a link from The Atlantic. So we'll see if it actually moves the needle on anything. But and he did make a couple of good points in his piece. But to me, knowing the history of Michael Gerson and knowing the role that he has played in perpetuating a lot of the problems that we are now reaping the consequences of, it felt so tone deaf. I read it and it felt so tone deaf. And I'm do you it felt like the equivalent to me, I think I said this to you earlier, of him putting his fingers in his ears and just going, la 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 la, I don't want to hear it. But I'm you everything that you have done has contributed to the problem that we are now in. And it just felt a cop-out, you're not owning your own stuff. And I think it would have been a much more powerful piece, frankly, if it had included a little bit of that self-reflective nature and a little bit of humility, yeah. Frankly.
Some mea culpa.
Yeah, of going gosh, I was a part of a problem for the last 20 plus years.
Yeah. And to be clear, he was a small part of the problem.
Absolutely.
I don't want to lay that at his feet.
No,
it just,
no.
It makes it hard for me to accept the power of the cover story overall.
Right.
Knowing his history. And again, I feel like a broken record on this stuff, but it comes up in his newspaper columns as well. He wrote some really powerful stuff around Roy Moore's candidacy and just, going after in really harsh terms the evangelicals who were encouraging people in Alabama to vote for Roy Moore. And yet I can't tell if it's that he feels like he needs to do this to retain some credibility with the right, or if he just can't help himself. But in those same columns, he would go after liberals and Democrats as pro-abortion. And, it's language like that that is why people have felt trapped voting for Republicans and staying within the religious right. And here, he just can't help himself from throwing out snarky little comments liberal Christians found better things to do with their Sundays than attend progressive services. That's been something he and Ross love to be like, liberals just prefer going to brunch than being in church because that's so boring on Sundays. Dude, look at the plank in your own eye because your numbers have been going down too. There is something going on.
Yep. And again, this is maybe I should just keep this to myself, but okay, would I rather the decline in a tradition be because we got a little boring? Or would I rather the decline in my tradition be because we married our tradition to a guy like Donald Trump? Both of them suck, but at the end of the day, I'd rather be associated with the one that didn't give up its heart and soul and sell its soul to the devil, frankly. And I mean, and your point about not laying it all at the feet of Michael Gerson is absolutely a good one, because he was just you know, a cog in a big wheel of a big machine that has moved us to this particular moment. There are so many points and so many people and so many aspects of our culture, our politics, and evangelicalism as a whole that has led us to where we are today. He was simply, but he was a piece of that. He did play a role, just like a lot of other people.
Can I bring up a specific
example? Yes, please.
He played a role. So I have, I think, more complicated feelings about faith-based initiatives than most people do. I think most people are either they love the idea of it or they hate it and they think it's totally inappropriate. I know how much good so many faith-inspired nonprofits do. And I also know that when it comes to federal funding, what we have found since folks started taking a really good look at the process starting in the Bush administration is that there is a bias in the process. It's a bias towards large institutions instead of small ones. And so one of the really good developments out of Bush deciding to make faith-based initiatives a big part of his domestic agenda is that the government for nearly 20 years now has been working on making it easier for smaller institutions to both build the capacity to manage grants, like federal grants, but also to even the process so that it doesn't weight so heavily in the direction of kind of the large behemoths who some people think end up providing less personal service just because of the nature of their size. So that is something really good that came out of all of this. And I would also add that the fact that the Obama administration continued that office and continued to focus on all the ways in which faith-based institutions could intersect with the government and provide both their own advice, since they work so closely with a lot of communities, and also receive some help from the government. And in many cases, you know, just form really close partnerships. Just to take one example, one thing that folks found from doing kind of an audit of how government and faith-based organizations work together is that, you know, there are a heck of a lot of kids at or near the poverty line in the U.S. who rely on school meals in order to be fed during the year. And in the summer, that then becomes a problem, especially if they're not in summer school. So the Department of Education and the Department of Agriculture, which has the oversight for school meals, and churches were able to work together to provide solutions for that gap over the summer and find ways to feed schools, to allow, say, federal funding for school lunches to be in vacation Bible schools and things like that. That was really just creative and innovative, and it was exactly what was kind of the best hope of people who were in favor of this. However, it is the case that, especially in the early years of the Bush administration, the folks in the White House really pushed the idea that this was a way to reward those constituencies who had supported Bush. I don't think it was ever as bad as critics and skeptics charged that it was going to be, but there's no question that they encouraged that perception and they didn't do anything publicly to discourage it. And that was one part of what I was talking about earlier of developing this sense among the public as large that there was partisan religion. And that this really was a, you know, pray to play thing. And that has hurt Christian witness. It really has. That's when we started seeing people turning away from religion in numbers that are like Europe after the Second World War. And the refusal to mention that in accounting the recent history just leaves out a huge piece of the story.
Yeah, it does. The other thing that I wanted to talk about that I feel like he left out, which we mentioned, or you kind of mentioned earlier, and I would love to bring on some folks to kind of dissect this a little bit more. And we are going to do an entire series on, you know, race and politics and religion as well. But I thought that the leaving out of particular instances of, you know, problems with race in terms of evangelicalism and politics was interesting. I don't want to assume that he did on purpose. I'm not going to assign ill intent here, but you can't help but notice it. And I know that there's been some really good commentary from people of color who are religious scholars, practitioners, who have come out and, you know, said like, huh, interesting that he left out the entire race conversation.
Yeah.
I think someone pointed me to something that someone said on Twitter. I'm not on Twitter, but I had to click the link through. And who was it? It was a thread from Jamar Tisby, maybe?
Jamar, yeah.
Was it Jamar?
He had a really thoughtful thread.
Yeah, he had a really thoughtful thread. We'll link to that as well. And just about his kind of avoidance of the problematic views and like the problematic, even theological positions of evangelicalism in its history. Like, I mean, Gerson lays out a piece in the Atlantic, a pretty robust history of evangelicalism, which I thought was helpful in some regards, but man, it left out a huge chunk that felt inconvenient, you know, that he left it out. And a huge section of that is about the implications of evangelical theology and its, you know, active nature in our culture as it regards to race.
Yeah. Well, he does take on, the church today and the problematic implications on race for supporting Trump the way that so many white evangelicals do. But it's interesting the way he frames that. He writes something like, they are risking their faith's reputation on matters of race, to which some people appropriately said, well, hang on a second. Does evangelicalism have a good reputation on matters of race?
Right.
Because
that was one of the places I was like, wait a second.
Isn't this the tradition that split churches in two over the Civil War and slavery and race?
Yeah, and segregation and on and on and on and on.
And supported lynching in some cases?
Yes.
Like, this is a problematic history.
Yeah. Yes. And so like to completely like to just couch it in today's terms without giving any sort of inclination of history as to how that like there's a history there. Like, it's not like it all of a sudden like we have a race problem in evangelicalism. Like, any person of color who has been an observer or practitioner of evangelicalism and evangelical history would say, there's always been a race problem here. And he just failed to mention it. And again, like, maybe it's just a point of privilege or lack of space. Again, I don't want to like assume ill intent there, but
yeah, I don't think it
was
it
just
ill
really
intent.
No, not at all. It's just like, interesting that you
I
would leave that
it
out.
It fits into his larger narrative about evangelicalism is kind of, I mean, this piece is a lament. That's the genre it fits into.
And yeah, that's a fair point.
So his larger narrative is a lament about the moral decline of evangelicalism. And the problem with that is it necessarily requires you to have this nostalgia about what evangelicalism used to be. I mean, it's not very different from Make America Great Again and assuming that, you know, there was this golden era. It's hard to have that lament and also really honestly grapple with problems in the past. I mean, he does accurately point to instances in American history when evangelicals really were among the leaders in some social movements. But I think It is mostly accurate to characterize evangelicalism as having always been a tradition where there are pockets of social activism, but in which that has always been the minority.
Yes.
And that has never been embraced and encouraged.
No, it hasn't been the dominant narrative at all. Yeah.
Yeah. And in many cases, you know, been shouted down by the majority. You know, this is when he goes after people who supported what is known as the social gospel in the early 20th century. He's got a line in the piece saying the social gospel was post-millennialism. And for the sake of those of you who don't want a divinity school lecture, we're going to just skip over discussion of postmillennialism, but he said,
yes,
it was drained of the miraculous, with social reform taking the place of the social coming, which, hold on there, cowboy. Like, that is not the way most proponents of the social gospel thought of it. And we are still today grappling with the consequences of talking about religion as if it is a zero-sum game.
That's exactly right. You are either involved
in trying to bring about social reform, or you are a true Christian focused on waiting for the second coming. And it drives me insane, and it is part of this narrative.
I hate either or language. Yeah, this like either or. Like it's like one or the other. It can't be both. It can't be like, there's just so many shades of gray, right? There's so much context and nuance and depth to evangelical history, to evangelical practice, to like all of these things, right? And to have this kind of reductionist mentality is just really heartbreaking. And again, I know that it's a lament piece, and he has some sort of idyllic version of Christianity in his head, but he perpetuates a lot of the problems, like even in this piece that like, I'm like, well, you're going to have some more to lament here. Once you like get past this point, it's like, oh, you just wrote about a whole bunch of other stuff that you're going to have to lament here eventually. You know what I mean? Like, so it's super frustrating. I wanted to go back to a point that you made about this is a lament piece, and he is lamenting some form of kind of idyllic version of evangelicalism. This is not the only piece. We kind of mentioned that there were four major pieces that were written about evangelicals just in like, I think they all got published on Monday. One of them, or like Sunday and Monday, one of them was the Atlantic piece. There was a piece in Forbes, which then got taken down. That was super weird. But then there was a piece in the New York Times about polling numbers amongst evangelical women dropping. And then there was another piece in the Atlantic from Emma Green talking about how sort of like a review of a book, actually.
Yeah. There's a new book kind of grappling with who's an evangelical
term. Yeah. Who is evangelical? And like the book is called, I think, Still Evangelical. And it's a collection of essays that was edited by a guy. But in that second Atlantic piece by Emma Green, and even in parts here in Michael Gerson's piece in the Atlantic as well, I kept hearing this thread of like, you know, oh, we have to reclaim the label. Like we have to like go back to what evangelicalism was originally intended to be, like talking about Bebbington's quadrilateral and like going back to really like the true theological implications of like what evangelicalism is. And like my question is, again, like you have to have a sort of idyllic picture of what evangelicalism was to want to go back to it. And I think a lot of people would look at that history and go, I don't think I want to go back, because I think there's inherent problems that were never addressed. And so here we are, and there's a lot of people wanting to reclaim evangelicalism to kind of wrestle it back from this, you know, moral decline that Gerson talks about in its marriage and ultimately its acceptance of Donald Trump. And my question, I don't know if it's for you or just for people who like genuinely want to reclaim the label, is like, okay, so what's your game plan here? Like, how are you going to like put that back in the box. Like, you know what I mean? Like, we have progressed so far along, and the cultural narrative and media narrative about who is evangelical, what that actually means, has diverged so far from its original intent that, like, my argument would be like, it's time to let the term die. Like, it's dead. Let it go and let something else new and beautiful be reborn out of what is dead, as, you know, to like harken back to some basic Christian theological imagery here. Like, what is dead will birth something that's new, resurrection. Like, let's talk about.
Yeah, I think this is a long conversation
for
another time. And we will also should also note, we're going to be coming back to tackle conversations about evangelicals and women and evangelicals and race in particular in future episodes in the very near future. And I want to leave us time to get onto the Pope Francis discussion. But my just very quick observation is two things. One is, for many of us, it's just basically stubbornness from knowing evangelicalism as the theological term that predated its current political understanding. And being like, people always point me to the scene from Office Space, one of the great, great cult movies.
I know exactly what scene you're going to tell me,
where
too.
The dude named Michael Bolton is like, why should I have to give it up? I had it first. Like, we had it first. They're the clowns who took it from us.
Oh, God, that movie's so funny.
But for me personally, and for the work that I'm involved with right now, it's a pragmatic decision.
Sure.
It's precisely because of the gaslighting that people like Gerson have been doing for decades with evangelicals in scaring them into thinking that liberal Christians are these boogeymen whose churches don't actually believe in Jesus. And if you leave our churches, I mean, it's really abusive language. It's, you know, if you leave us, you are, you know, going to be stuck with these people who won't understand you and can't provide for you spiritually. And so just as a way to provide a bridge out or over here where, you know, there are Christians of deep faith, but who believe they can practice it in a different way than the right has been doing. I want to hang on to evangelical, not only because it really does describe theologically the way I relate to my faith, but also because I think it makes it easier for those kind of evangelicals who are open to thinking about their faith tradition in a different way to be willing to engage and to interact instead of just saying, I'm a Christian, to which, you know, they have been told for decades, they're not really, they're just using the name Christian, but they don't believe like you and I
right,
do.
Right. Okay.
So that's my kind of pragmatic explanation.
Okay. Well, we're going to have to dig into that in a later episode because holy cow, there's so much to unpack. I feel like there's so much to unpack about the state of evangelicalism, why we would leave it behind, what are we moving toward, or what is evangelicalism moving toward, and we'll have to bring some people in to kind of unpack it for us. But for the sake of time, I think maybe we should move on to our second discussion. What do we think?
Absolutely.
Okay. So moving on to our second theme today, we absolutely could not let the fifth anniversary of Pope Francis's papacy pass without acknowledging it. He is one of those rare religious leaders who captivates people even outside of his tradition, and who appears to be remaking at least some parts of the church in real time. And to do justice to the topic, we knew we had to turn to Anthea Butler, a superstar academic and Catholic at the University of Pennsylvania. She is one of the experts providing commentary about Francis on CNN's six-week docuseries about the Pope. And Amy spoke to her about what's been so noteworthy about this Pope's papacy so far.
All right. Thank you for joining us to talk about the fifth anniversary of Pope Francis's papacy. I have to admit that there are certainly times in my journalism career when I've made bad predictions, but the election of Pope Francis ranks up there among the worst. I'm remembering now all of us religion folks kind of hanging on the coverage, waiting to see who was going to be selected 5 years ago, and then needing to go, write something right now on who this guy is. And I think my assessment was something like, seems like, you know, he's got the trappings of being different, but probably more of the same.
Oh, wow. Can I say, I was wrong. but not in a bad way. Not in a bad way.
So 5 years in, obviously, I was very wrong. And Pope Francis has been having an impact on the church that maybe nobody, even his biggest fans, could have foreseen. What at this point kind of strikes you? I'm not going to do the journalism thing of having you name the top thing that he's changed about the church, but what most strikes you when you think about the last 5 years and his influence?
It's really simple to me. Tone. The tone is so different. It's actually fantastic. Even when Pope Francis messes up, you know, like he just did in this last trip to Latin America, where he sort of sided with a guy who basically, you know, is under investigation for molestation and some other stuff, and said, I don't think anything's wrong with him. Even in his most sort of unguarded sense, it's the tone in which he talks to the public and Catholics in the world that's completely different and is so unlike most of what has come out of the Vatican before. And so I think if he does nothing else but change the tone, he will have helped the church immensely.
Mm-hmm. And I know a lot of that is just him personally, and we could name all the examples of kind of his compassion, just working to help get some Syrian refugees out last week is one example. But it seems like he's also setting the tone in terms of the personnel of the church and who he is choosing to raise up to certain positions.
Yeah, no, I think that's very true. I mean, I think, you know, you can tell with, you know, at least with the depictive who's going to be cardinals, that is coming from, you know, what we used to call a two-thirds world. I used to just call it the world now for me. And also to try to get a sense of, to sort of break this sort of this block between what, you know, has happened in the past with John Paul II and continued on with Benedict XVI. So I think he's bringing new personnel in. What troubles me, and what I think, you know, it will be his further bigger issue, is how he continues to deal with sex abuse. And so the first commission is over that he set up, and people resigned from that commission for various reasons. The second commission he says he's doing, I hope has more traction than the first one. I hope that they can really start to dig in deep to this issue, because it's going to be something that continues to plague the church. And we've only been through the first round of this. And I think that if Francis wants to leave an indelible mark on the church and have a, you know, I don't know what you would call a successful papacy, basically. But if he wanted to have a successful papacy, I think one of the things he has to do is to be very sincere and direct about sexual abuse in the church, and to set up structures that helps to eradicate it.
Yeah, how much is that his role as Pope, and obviously if he wanted to, he could say this is going to be our number one priority, and how much of that is the Vatican and kind of a built-in resistance to addressing this?
Well, I think his role is to, you know, I hate to put it like this, but I think in this particular case, it's what's needed. He needs to bulldoze down the old system. And what I mean by that is that he has to do things that will make that change come. This is the institution that moves, you know, slower than a snail, okay? They've had 2,000 years of, like, not having to do stuff. So it's easy to just say, you know, verbally, I want to make changes. Here's a commission or whatever. It has to go deeper than that. I mean, in some ways, and I'll give Benedict credit for this, a lot of the structure that started to come into place that was trying to help the church in terms of adjudicating these cases and things, some of that came from Benedict, and when we have to give him credit for that. Other part of it is for Francis, is that he has, there are places within the Vatican administration that obviously, you know, are, I wouldn't say thwarting him, that might be a big word to say, but they are in opposition to what he wants to do. And what he has to do is to get enough, you know, sort of outside support and, you know, use the Catholic thing that always works for everybody who's Catholic, which is shame. Mm-hmm. I mean, you got to shame them into doing stuff. And this is something that I think is really important for the future health of the church.
Mm-hmm. You know, it strikes me that for somebody who has changed the tone as much as he has, he is still pretty tin-eared when it comes to talking about women.
Oh, yeah.
Which raises for me the question of whether this is just something built into the male-led faith, that even somebody who is as compassionate and open-minded as Francis just has blinders when it comes to speaking of women as real humans. I mean, even when he is trying to be complimentary, he's dehumanizing because he holds them up as just paragons of virtue who, you know, are wondrous and serve the church with all of their gifts. But that in itself doesn't approach them as real people.
Yeah, no, it's his biggest problem and maybe his biggest flaw. And I'd be the first one to say that because I think, you know, he comes into this two ways. One, I think it's a cultural thing for him, you know, and secondarily, I also think that it is a clerical problem for him. In other words, if you're used to dealing with, you know, women who help you, serve you, and do all this other stuff, seeing them in comparable positions and be able to make the decision-making kinds of things that they can is, you know, he's not there, and I wish he would be there. On the other hand, the other part of the situation was happening before he got there, which was the whole thing about looking at the nuns, right? Mm-hmm. With the curia investigating them. So this was a problem. It has, you know, I would say that it's not blown over, even though we have a report and everything has happened, but it is at least put us in the sense that nothing is going to happen to any of the nuns who were active here in the States right now in terms of the kinds of social justice work that they were doing. Mm-hmm. He has to get better about it. I mean, you know, let me put it like this. There was no reason for Pope Francis to have to reiterate there will never be women priests because we all know that, like, dude, you're going to die. We're all going to die. And in 100 years, there's not going to be enough men to do this, and so you're going to have women anyway. You can say this to the cows come home. This is going to happen because you're going to have a problem with you don't have enough people now, and there are women who are already doing everything else but consecrating the host, and in mm-hmm. some places they are. So, you know, what are you going to do? Stop trying to pretend like this is not going to happen.
You and I were talking just before we came on to this about one of the less commented upon aspects of his papacy, which is that it is occurring while his predecessor is still alive. And I would add to that, that in addition to kind of the remarkable situation of having two popes at the same time, we have potentially a precedent that he may intend to repeat of stepping down the way that Benedict did, which adds kind of another layer of urgency to his work. Kind of for those of us who are watching what he's doing, another way to kind of assess it.
Yeah, no, I think I kind of actually hope he does go ahead and retire. Because I think that will be enough. Two in a row retiring will send a signal that this is the right thing to do. I mean, you know, if you take into his Jesuit, you know, background, You know, in the Jesuit order, the generals retire. The generals have a thing where they retire at 80. And so why not just go, right? Because this is a way to show that the church will not be held captive by a person who doesn't have, some people do at 80, but not everybody. The physical strength to be able to do the kind of traveling and what is required of that particular position. And I don't think, some people may call it ageism. I call it, this is the proper maintenance of the church, in a sense, because you can't run an organization like this and be frail. You really just can't. You will be taken advantage of. And I think this is the case of what happened with Pope Benedict. There were things that got really out of his control. You know, when your personal butler is stealing your stuff and printing it and selling it to people, things have gotten out of control, right? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think, I hope at least if he plans on doing this, that it's done in such a way that, you know, we can think about that he's done the work that he wants to do. And I think probably the biggest thing he wants to do is stack the deck with cardinals. That's what I think is happening. Mm-hmm. The rest of the stuff might be secondary, but I think what he wants to do in terms of steering the church in a certain kind of direction to think about what's going on is that he wants to be able to have people who are more representative of the places where the church is actually thriving and growing instead of the places where the church is dying, like, you know, Western Europe and let's say here in America too, for a lot of reasons. Mm-hmm.
What kind of precedent have he and Benedict set in terms of their relationship?
You know, I think just actually the fact that you see them together in pictures, I mean, I know it's a photo op, but I think it's a good one in the sense that I don't try to couch this as maybe some of the right-wing Catholics would to say, oh, you know, he's totally disrespecting everything that Benedict XVI stood for, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think the kind of relationship that they have where they appear, you know, sometimes at masses together, he goes over for his birthday and all that, is one of collegiality. And I think that's important for people to see, especially for Catholics to see, because this is an anomalous situation. You know, back in the 14th century when this happened for Avignon popes in Rome, everybody was trying to kill each other, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and this is not the case right now. But I do think, and I'll say this, and I've said it in jest from the very beginning, but it is a ring of truth in it. I think it's also important that Pope Francis did not stay in the regular quarters of the Pope in the Vatican. He, you know, decided to move to Casa Santa Marta. And that, to me, is a sign that he's like, I'm not going to do what everybody else did. Let me do something different because this is a different time. And so even just that fact of physically not sleeping in that room where Benedict was and John Paul II was and everybody else is, it says something different about what time we're in.
So you think that would be an important precedent to follow for the next pope as well?
I think, you know, yeah, why not? Because, I mean, I think part of it is also about, too, how do you show humility, right? This is a hard way to show humility when you're a pope, right? And you've got this big, you know, everything is gold and wonderful and all of that, right? But to not be in that room, to not take those quarters, to just use them for certain kinds of things and not to live there is a sign that, you know, I want to be a servant of the people as opposed to being like this guy who lives in a big gilded cage. Well, you know, and then also the other part was, you know, facetiously I said, this is much easier for you to go live in a place where everybody else is so nobody can poison you, but, you know.
Mm-hmm. How much has the kind of coexistence of two popes, though, maybe exacerbated the tensions between conservatives and liberals in the church? Because I can see from the point of view of some conservative Catholics, we're 5 years in and Benedict's still around. Their, you know, frustration that we could have had five more years of this guy and importantly of him appointing people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think he would have had five more years of him if he had stayed. I think he'd be dead by now. Hmm. He has five more years because he quit. Because that was already killing him. He had already, you know, whether the Vatican Bank scandal, which didn't get a lot of press here, but it was really bad. You know, his own scandal with his butler. There were too many things going on. I think whatever made him throw in the towel. Let's go back for a minute because I think this is an important story. I want to be with Padua, where the last pope who resigned, he actually laid his pallium. This was a couple of years before the resignation. Pope Benedict laid his pallium on his grave. That probably was a signal back then that he was going to resign, but nobody picked up on it. A very smart Jesuit friend of mine, Jim Pratt, told me about that story. And I was like, oh, he probably was already signaling way back then that he was going to do this. Yeah, that he was going to do this. And not many people picked up on it. But I think, you know, the problem for conservative Catholics is they still see him as being the pope. At least that's the pope they want. Right? As opposed to being the pope that they have. And they have to understand that the pope that they want resigned. The pope that they wanted did the one thing that they never expected to have happen. He resigned. He did that for the good of the church. And whether or not they agree with Francis, what you do have to understand is that that was of his own free will. He did it. And he says that in his statement. Yeah, I did this. This is what I'm doing. Nobody's making me do this. So I think that for them, it's still the grief of losing this pope that for them was perfect, you know, doctrinally and in every other way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, in some ways, like those who have lost the White House and whichever party it is, just have a hard time accepting the new administration. Interesting. That's really fascinating about him visiting the grave. Most people missed that.
People just didn't pay attention to it. I mean, it was like one of those things where you're like, oh, well, I don't know, right? But it's just a thing he did. But I'm like, oh, he probably really was trying to tell people. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, the thing about him is that I think you always have to see him as somebody who, you know, started off one way, you know, in terms of how he saw things in the 60s and then became a lot more conservative. And then in the end has always wanted to put the needs of the church first. Mm-hmm. And I think that's pretty important, at least in that sense, if we think about that.
Well, it's a good time to be alive and be somebody who's a church watcher. Definitely an exciting time. Any thoughts about kind of what you're going to have your eye on for the next year or so out of Francis's work?
Well, I think two things. One is sex abuse, obviously, but mm-hmm. I think the second thing for me personally is to sort of watch what's happening. Well, one thing that's what's happening is what's going to happen with China and the bishops. I think that's a huge thing. If he comes to an agreement with the government, then I'm not sure what that means for Christians in China. I don't think it means something good, and I kind of wonder why he's doing that. So that's number one. Number two is I'm interested to see when he's going to go back head-to-head with Trump. I see it coming. And depending on what happens next, you know, in terms of North Korea and all of that, I think we can see him become much more vocal than he already has been in these kinds of world affairs in terms of war. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, he may be the only moral authority that could stand up against Trump right now. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's a showdown that's coming. It's going to come. It is going to come. And I don't know how, I don't know when, but I think it's going to come.
That actually reminds me of something, and this will be my last question. But while I have you on the phone, I have been fascinated by the way in which this administration has both not been interested in reaching out to Catholics and, in fact, in times gone out of their way to diss Catholics. I mean, I know Steve Bannon's not part of it anymore, but, you know, he was going after the Pope last week and has been disparaging Catholics for forever, really. Is that going to have an impact, or is it having an impact with American Catholics, at least at the leadership level? Because this is not a way that they're used to being treated by Republicans.
No, they're not used to being treated this way. And, you know, let me say this bluntly. I hope that it makes maybe the Catholic bishops will finally get in line and realize that this is that their alliance with evangelicals maybe hasn't been as fruitful as they would like it to be. Mm-hmm. Right? you know? So this is the issue. And I think that they need to figure, they have now figured this out, that they are not, they don't have the kind of, favor with this particular president that they should. And moreover, they have a dangerous situation because of immigration and ICE right now, picking up, you know, most of the people that they're picking up are Catholics. Mm-hmm. So I think that they have to sort of make their peace with the fact that this is not their president, first of all, and a second, that some of these alliances that they've made have not been the best ones for them mm-hmm. or for the church. And that, you know, this upcoming clash that I think is going to happen will help clarify that for them, I think, a lot more. But, you know, my own archbishop over here, Archbishop Chaput, I mean, it's got to be really troubling for somebody like him, because on the one hand, he has to try to figure out what's going on with, you know, the immigrant situation in ICE. But at the same time, he's for some of these kind of conservative things that have happened. And I think this is where some moral choices have to be made by the cardinals and the bishops.
Mm-hmm. And fascinating that it's going to be, it's fascinating that it will be a Republican administration that forces that. But interesting stuff. Well, thank you so much. And we're going to look forward to watching you on the next 5 weeks of Pope.
All right. Thanks so much.
So that was a fascinating interview. I know the audio might have been a little tough. Anthea was on her cell phone, but she is one of the best people to talk to on so many religion topics, but especially Pope Francis. And one of the things I was thinking about as she was kind of talking about his popularity and how he has kind of changed the tone of the church is, not to go back to our evangelical topics that we always seem to end up back at, but I do think that the Catholic Church is an instructive example of what can happen when believers start to lose faith in an institution. Because even with Pope Francis's high popularity, and even with kind of how beloved he is around the world and his different tone, the Catholic Church is not bringing in more people. You know, the question when Francis was elected to the papacy is this going to bring disillusioned Catholics back to the church? And the answer is no. It has not, at least in America. And so, you know, these things have long-term consequences. The Catholics who left, you know, within the last 15, 20 years because of sex abuse scandals and how the church covered them up, as well as Catholics who left during Benedict years, when the church seemed really focused on being smaller and purer, they are gone. They are not coming back. And if I was an evangelical leader right now, I would be pretty darn worried about the fact that the brand is not doing well. And people who are being turned off from evangelicalism, and more broadly, let's just admit it, Christianity in general, they may not come back after the Trump era, after the Franklin Graham and Jerry Falwell and Robert Jeffress era. You can get better people on top, but that does not guarantee that you're going to be able to turn things around.
Yeah, for sure. It's so interesting that you brought this up, because as I was kind of thinking through just the implications of, you know, the last 15, 20 years of what has happened in the Catholic Church, I did actually think about how it correlates in some way with what's happening with evangelicalism right now. And it just goes to show that systemic problems that run that deep, that hit so acutely at almost like the heart and the morality and the values of the entire tradition, in the case of the Catholics, it was obviously the sex abuse scandal. I mean, it was so far reaching. It affected people so deeply. I mean, the loss of trust from the top down and the bottom up. I mean, it just went both ways. Was immense, just immense. And obviously they are reaping the consequences of that now with, you know, people leaving the church and not coming back, even with this like amazing, charismatic, loving leader. And the same, yeah, the same is definitely true for evangelicals. And it actually makes me question, like, looking at the selling out of the core of what evangelicals have always claimed and selling out of the values that evangelicals have always claimed the high ground on for the sake of political alignment and power with Donald Trump, it makes me wonder, like, all of these people who are now fleeing evangelicalism, like, how far reaching is that going to go? And it's hard to imagine that it's not going to be similar. Like, the betrayal that is felt now, obviously, like, those who were abused sexually at the hands of leaders in the Catholic Church, like, that's like a whole other planet of abuse, clearly.
Except we've also got some of that coming up these days in evangelical churches as well.
Yeah, that is true.
And you know, we've talked about some of that and we can get into more of it, but yes. Yeah. Granted that is a certain kind of loss of trust that is just incredibly, it goes so deep.
Right. Yeah. And I said that simply to say, like, I'm not trying to equate the two in, like, harm done, obviously, to individuals. And I mean, what happened in the Catholic Church is obviously horrific. And so I don't want to equate, like, loss of trust because of Donald Trump with loss of trust because people were horrifically abused for years. But a loss of trust is at the core a loss of trust in an institution. And I can't help but see some parallels here and looking at how many people are fleeing because they feel a deep sense of betrayal and a deep sense of betrayal to what has historically been evangelical values. And it's sad and it's going to force a reckoning. And if it hasn't already, I mean, I think there are a lot of people asking really hard questions, which is good. But to your point, yeah, I think that it just goes to show that it doesn't matter who you put at the top, like, betrayal is betrayal. And chances are you're probably not going to get those folks back. And so what does that say about how you move forward as an institution and also about, like, who you put in leadership in those institutions as well? So, I mean, Francis was obviously a breath of fresh air, especially after Benedict, for a lot of people. And so that was really encouraging. But yeah, it's a steep uphill climb from here. So super fascinating. Okay, well, that is all for this week's episode. Thank you so much for joining us. Impolite Company is produced every week by Constantine Hios. If you've enjoyed our conversation, please, please, please rate us on iTunes. It is the very best way to let other people know about us. And if you'd like to support the show, check out our Patreon page and consider supporting us financially so we can continue to expand these conversations. And as always, we'll post the show notes on our website. Until next week, have fun storming the castle, kids.